It was almost 4 o'clock in the morning when he reached Chirundi Bridge. There was a solitary corporal in the police charge office. His arms were folded on the desk in front of him, cradling his head. He was so soundly asleep that Daniel had to shake him vigorously, and his eyes were swollen and bloodshot when at last he raised his head and blinked uncomprehendingly at Daniel. "I want to report a murder, a multiple murder," Daniel began the long, laborious process of getting the official machinery in motion. When the corporal seemed unable to decide upon the correct procedure, Daniel sent him to call the member in charge from his rendezvous at the back of the station house. When the sergeant came into the charge office at last, he was dressed in full uniform, including Sam Brown belt and cap, but he was still half asleep. "Ring CID in Harare," Daniel urged him. "They must send a unit to Chiwewe."
"If first you must make a statement," the sergeant insisted.
There was no typewriter in the charge office. This was a remote rural station. The sergeant took down Daniel's statement in halting, childlike long hand. His lips moved as he spelled out each separate letter silently. Daniel wanted to take the ballpoint away from him and get it down himself.
"Damn it, sergeant! Those dead people are lying out there. The killers are getting away while we sit here."
The sergeant went on placidly with his composition, and Daniel corrected his spelling and fumed with exasperation. However, the pace of the dictation allowed him to phrase his statement carefully. He set down the timetable of the previous day's events, the time that he had left Chiwewe and said goodbye to Johnny Inzu, the time he had found the signs of the raiding party and decided to return to the headquarters camp with a warning, and the time that he had met the refrigerator trucks on the road in company with the ambassador's Mercedes. He described his conversation with Ambassador Ning, and hesitated, wondering whether to mention the bloodstain that he had noticed on his blue slacks. It would sound like an accusation.
"Ah, the hell with protocol," he decided,
and described in detail the blue slacks and the training shoes with fish-scale patterned soles.
"They'll have to investigate Ning now."
He felt a grim satisfaction as he went on to describe his return to Chiwewe and the carnage he'd found there. He made sure to mention the note in Johnny's hand and the fish-scale pattern of the blood footprint on the office floor without specifically relating either to the Taiwanese ambassador. Let them make their own inferences. He had a great deal of difficulty when it came to describing his pursuit of the Mercedes and the refrigerator trucks. He had to give his motives without incriminating himself or pointing too definitely at the suspicions he entertained towards Ning Cheng Gong. "I followed the convoy to ask them if they had any knowledge of the missing ivory," he dictated. "Although I was unable to catch up with Ambassador Ning and the leading truck, I did speak to Ranger Gomo, whom I met on the Karoi Road and who was driving the second refrigerator truck. He denied any knowledge of these events and allowed me to inspect the contents of the truck. I found no ivory." It galled him to have to admit this, but he had to cover himself against any charges that Gomo might bring against him later. "I then determined that my duty was to contact the nearest police station and report the deaths of the Chiwewe warden, his family and staff, and the burning and destruction of buildings and other property." It was well after daybreak when Daniel could at last sign the handwritten statement, and only then would the police sergeant respond to his urging to telephone CID headquarters in Harare. This led to a protracted telephone discussion between the sergeant and a series of increasingly senior detectives in Harare as one passed him on to the other. This was the pace of Africa, and Daniel gritted his teeth. AWA, he told himself. Africa wins again. At last it was ordered that the sergeant should drive out to Chiwewe camp in the station Land Rover while a team of detectives flew down from Harare to land at the park's airstrip. "Do you want me to come out with you to Chiwewe?" Daniel asked when the sergeant finally relinquished the telephone and began preparations for his expedition to the camp. The sergeant looked nonplussed by the question. He had received no instructions from CID as to what to do with the witness.
You leave an address and telephone number where we can contact you if we need you," he decided, after a great deal of frowning thought.
Daniel was relieved to be turned loose. Since arriving at the Chirundu police station, he had had many hours in which to consider the situation and make his plans to cover every contingency. If Isaac Matwetwe had been able to capture any of the poachers, that would still be the swiftest path to Ning Cheng Gong. But he had to talk to Isaac before he handed over his prisoners to the police.
I want to use your telephone,
he told the police corporal as soon as the station commander and his unit of armed constables had driven away in the green Land Rover, heading for Chiwewi.
A police telephone, the corporal shook his head. Not public telephone.
Daniel produced a blue 10 Zim dollar note and laid it on the desk in front of him.
It's only a local call, he explained,
and the banknote vanished miraculously. The corporal smiled and waved him towards the telephone. Daniel had made a friend.
Isaac Matwetwe answered the call almost immediately. The Karoi telephone exchange made the connection to Mana Pools.
Isaac, Daniel blurted with relief, when did you get back?
I have just walked into my office this minute, Isaac told him. We got back 10 minutes ago. I have one man wounded. I must get him to hospital.
You made contact then?
Yes, we made contact.
Like you said, Danny, a big gang, bad guys.
Did you get any prisoners, Isaac? Daniel demanded eagerly. If you managed to grab a couple of them, we're home and dry.
Isaac Matwetwe stood at the wheel of the 20-foot assault craft and ran downriver in the night. His rangers squatted on the deck below the gunwale and huddled into their greatcoats, for it was cold out on the water, with the wind of their passage accentuating the chill of the river mist. The outboard motor was running rough and cutting out intermittently. Twice Isaac had to let the boat drift while he went back to work on it. It badly needed a full overhaul, but there was never enough foreign exchange available for spares to be imported. He got her running again and pointed the bows downstream. A thick slice of moon spiked up above the dark trees that lined the bank of the Zambezi. It gave Isaac just enough light to push the boat up to top speed. Although he knew each curve and stretch of the river intimately for the next 50 miles, right down to Tet and to the Mozambique border, the shallows and rocky outcrops were too complex even for him to run in complete darkness. The glow of moonlight turned the patches of river mist to iridescent pearl dust and gave to the open water a luster like polished black obsidian. The subdued hum of the motor and the speed of their progress gave no advance warning. They drew level with the hippopotamuses feeding in the reed banks before the monstrous amphibians were aware of their arrival. In panic, they tobogganed down the steep and slippery paths into the river and went through the surface in a welter of spray. The flocks of wild duck roosting in the lagoons and quiet backwaters were more alert. The assault boat's approach sent them aloft on whistling wings, silhouetted against the rising moon. Isaac knew exactly where he was heading. He had been a freedom fighter during the Bush War and had crossed the same river to raid the white farms and harass the security forces of Ian Smith's illegal regime. He knew all the techniques and all the tricks that the poachers employed. Some of them had been his comrades in arms in the struggle, but they were the new enemy now. He hated them as much as he had ever hated the Salus scouts or the Rhodesian light infantry. The Zambezi was almost half a mile wide along the stretch below Chirundu and Mana Pools. The raiders would need craft to cross its mighty green flood. They would get them the same way the guerrillas once had, from the local fisherfolk. The Zambezi supports an itinerant population of fishermen who build their villages upon her banks. The villages are impermanent, for the tenor of their lives is dictated by the Zambezi's moods. When the river floods her banks and inundates the floodplains, the people must move to higher ground. They must follow the migrations of the shoals of tilapia and tigerfish and barbelled catfish on which they live. So every few months the clusters of rude thatched huts, with their fish-smoking racks and smouldering fires, are abandoned and allowed to fall into decay as the tribe moves on. It was part of Isaac's duty to monitor the movements of the fisherfolk, for their exploitation of the river had a profound effect on the river ecology. Now he smelled the smoke and the odour of drying fish on the night air and throttled back the motor. Softly he crept in towards the northern bank. If the poachers had come from Zambia, that was where they would return. The odour of fish was strong, and tendrils of smoke drifted out low across the water to mingle with the mist. There were four huts with shaggy thatched roofs in an angle of the bank, and four long dugout canoes drawn up on the narrow beach below them. Isaac nosed the assault craft onto the beach and jumped ashore, leaving one of his rangers to hold the bows. An old woman crawled out of the low door of one of the huts. She wore only a skirt of lechwe antelope skins around her waist, and her breasts were empty and pendulous.
"I see you, old mother,"
Isaac greeted her respectfully. He always took pains to maintain good relations with the river folk.
"I see you, my son,"
the old woman giggled, and Isaac smelled the rank odour of cannabis on her. The Batonka people pound the weed into a paste, then mould it with fresh cow dung into balls which they dry in the sun and smoke in clay pipes with reed mouthpieces. The government had granted them special dispensation to continue the tradition. It was particularly prevalent amongst the old women of the tribe.
"Are all your men in their huts?" Isaac asked quietly. "Are all of the canoes on the beach?"
The old woman blew her nose before she replied. She blocked one nostril with her thumb and from the other shot a shaft of silver mucus into the fire. She wiped the residue from her upper lip with the palm of her hand.
"All of my sons and their wives are asleep in their huts, and their children with them," she cackled.
"You saw no strange men with guns who wished you to ferry them across the river,"
Isaac insisted, and the old woman shook her head and scratched herself.
"We saw no strangers."
"I honour you, old mother," Isaac told her formally, and pressed a small paper packet of sugar into her withered paw. "Stay in peace."
He ran back to the assault craft. The ranger cast off and jumped aboard as soon as Isaac started the motor. The next village was 3 miles further downstream. Once again Isaac went ashore. He knew the headman of this village and found him sitting alone in the smoke from the fish-drying fires to keep off the singing clouds of malarial mosquitoes. 20 years before, the headman had lost one of his feet to a crocodile, but he was still one of the most intrepid boatmen on the river. Isaac greeted him and gave him a packet of cigarettes and squatted beside him in the smoke.
"You sit alone, Baba. Why can't you sleep? Are there things that trouble you?"
"An old man has many memories to trouble him,"
the headman was evasive.
"Like strangers with guns who demand passage in your canoes?"
Isaac asked.
"Did you give them what they wanted, Baba?"
The headman shook his head.
"One of the children saw them crossing the flood plains and ran to warn the village. We had time to hide the canoes in the reed beds and run away into the bush."
"How many men?"
Isaac encouraged him. The old man showed the fingers of both hands twice.
"They were hard men with guns and faces like lions," he whispered. "We were afraid."
"When was this, Baba?"
"The night before last,"
the headman replied.
"When they found no people in the village and no canoes, they were angry. They shouted at each other and waved their guns. But in the end they went away."
He pointed with his chin eastwards down the river.
"But now I am afraid they will return. That is why I sit awake while the village sleeps."
"Are the people of Imbepura still camped at the place of the red birds?"
Isaac asked, and the headman nodded.
"I think that after these hard men left here, they went down to Imbepura's village."
Thank you, old father."
The place of the red birds was named for the flocks of carmine-breasted bee-eaters which burrow their nests into the steep cutaway bank of the river at that point. Mbapura's village was on the north bank, across the river from the clay cliff of the breeding colony. Isaac approached it with the engine idling softly, allowing the flow of the Zambezi to drift him down. All the rangers were alert. They had discarded their greatcoats and now crouched down below the gunwale with their weapons ready. With a soft burst of the engine, Isaac pushed in closer to the bank. Mbapura's village was another tiny group of shaggy huts near the water's edge. They seemed deserted, and the drying fires below the fish racks had been allowed to burn out. However, he saw in the gleam of the moon that the mooring poles of the canoes were still standing in the shallow muddy landing, but the canoes were missing. The fisher folk lived by their canoes, their most precious possession. Isaac let the assault craft drift on downstream, well below the village, before he gunned the motor and cut back across the flow of the Zambezi, crossing half a mile of open water to the south bank. If the gang had crossed there, then they would be coming back the same way. Isaac checked the time, turning the luminous dial of his wristwatch to catch the moonlight. He calculated the distance from Chiwewe headquarters and divided by the probable rate of march of the poachers, and made allowance for the fact that they were probably carrying heavy loads of plundered ivory. He looked up at the moon. Already it was paling at the approach of dawn. He could expect the returning raiders to get back to the Zambezi bank any time within the next 2 or 3 hours.
"If I can find out where they have cached the canoes," he muttered.
His guess was that they had commandeered Mbapura's entire flotilla of canoes. He recalled that on his last visit to the village, there had been 7 or 8 of these frail craft, each of them hollowed out from a massive log of the Kigelia tree. Each of them could accommodate 6 or 7 passengers for the journey across the great river. The gang would probably have dragooned the men from the village to act as boatmen. The handling of the canoes required skill and experience, for the canoes were cranky and unstable, especially under a heavy load. He guessed that they would probably have left the boatmen under guard on the south bank while they marched on to Chowewi.
"If I can find the canoes, I have got them cold," Isaac decided.
He turned the assault boat in towards the south bank a little downstream from where he judged that the canoes would have crossed. When he found the entrance to a lagoon, he pressed the sharp bows into the dense stand of papyrus reeds that blocked the mouth. He cut the engine, and his rangers used handfuls of the tough papyrus stems to pull themselves deeper into the reed bed, while Isaac stood in the bows and sounded for bottom with a paddle. As soon as it was shallow enough, Isaac and one of his senior rangers waded ashore, leaving the rest of the party to guard the boat. On dry land, Isaac gave his ranger whispered orders, sending him downriver to search for the canoes and check the bank for signs of the passage of a large party of marauders. And when he had gone, Isaac set off in the opposite direction, upstream. He went alone, swiftly and silently, moving like a wraith in the river mist. He had judged it accurately. He had not gone more than 1/2 mile upstream when he smelt smoke. It was too strong and fresh to originate from the village on the far side of the broad river, and Isaac knew that there were no habitations on this bank. This was part of the national park. He moved in quietly towards the source of the smoke. At this point, the bank was a sheer red clay cliff into which the bee-eaters burrowed their subterranean nests. However, there was a break in the cliff directly below where he crouched. It was a narrow gully, choked with riverine bush, that formed a natural landing place from the river. The faint glimmer of coming dawn gave Isaac just sufficient light to make out the encampment in the gully below him. The canoes were drawn up well out of the water so that they would be concealed from anyone searching from a boat. There were 7 canoes, the entire flotilla from Imbapura's village across the river. Nearby, the boatmen were lying around 2 small smoky fires. They were wrapped in karosses of animal skin, and as protection from mosquitoes, each of them had drawn the covering completely over his head, so they looked like corpses laid out in a morgue. An armed poacher sat at each fire with his AK-47 rifle across his lap, guarding the sleeping boatmen and making certain that none of them sneaked away to the beached canoes nearby.
Danny figured it exactly right, Isaac told himself. They are waiting for the return of the raiding party.